Hello.
Robert Stark here. My guest for today is John Robb. Hey John, it's nice having you back on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
So our last show, we touched upon the issue of fourth generation warfare, and we're going to be focusing on that issue throughout the show. Can you give us a history of fourth generation warfare?
Sure. Well, fourth generation warfare came out of the work of Bill Lind and other innovators, and they were looking at the evolution of warfare in a generational model. Mostly, it has to do with the way armies fight, and in the generational model, the first generation is a linear warfare. It would be like the Napoleonics. And then it moved on to First World War with trench warfare, and then on to maneuver warfare, and then post-maneuver warfare, we got into guerrilla warfare as the fourth generation. And I latched onto that as an explanation for much of what we're seeing in terms of how people are fighting today. But as I got into it, I found that, a lot of the things that I was seeing happening in Iraq and other places was substantially different than even, what the guerrilla warfare was, 20,
So,
30 years ago.
are you saying so guerrilla warfare is that considered fourth generation warfare?
Yeah, guerrilla warfare is basically state versus non-state. Irregular units fighting regular units, and that it's a it's a un relatively unstructured warfare. But I mean, what we saw in Iraq and what we've seen, with Al Qaeda and we've seen with ISIS today and in other places around the world, most conflict now is well beyond that. I mean, it's gotten to a point where it's like many versus many conflict. It's an open source conflict.
Or in our last show, you brought up the there's a new thing going on called eye warfare.
Yeah, well, that was my, eye warfare is this idea that, any individual can declare war and disrupt global commerce or the functions of an organization based on what they have available in their technical toolkit,
So would you
in the
say
toolkit that virtually all of us have.
the Vietnam War
Yep, go
was
ahead.
that the beginning of a fourth generation warfare?
Well, I mean, fourth generation warfare became, predominant. Guerrilla warfare became predominant due to the capability of nuclear weapons to destroy the world. And what happened is that big nation states that used to go to war, conventional war, total war, to resolve disputes, weren't able to do that anymore. They were too worried that, any conflict would result in a nuclear conflagration that would, consume everybody. And that's combined with, economic interdependence. Economic interdependence has made nations interreliant because of, economic ties and trade and the like, communications. And the combination of fear of nuclear war and economic interdependence has pretty much eliminated big state versus state conflict. I mean, we don't have any world wars anymore. We don't even have any brushfire wars anymore. It's gotten down to the only place that we could have attacked, or the U.S. could have attacked in the last 20 years was Iraq, because it was disconnected from the global economy through sanctions, and that it didn't have any nuclear weapons that would result in anything
Would you say
huge in terms of war.
that these groups, like the one ISIS, are they? Would you describe them as proxies for certain states?
Oh no, I mean, that used to be the case, is that, guerrilla wars in some cases were a method of proxy warfare between nuclear powers that weren't able to fight directly. So you'd fund a guerrilla group and they would conduct warfare for you. And I mean, the structures of guerrilla groups, you know, when you either you look at Algeria or you know, when it was going up against France, or all the way up through to, you know, Vietnam and all the conflicts, the big conflicts before and after that in guerrilla warfare, were all run by insurgencies that had a structure that was similar to a nation state. They had a, you know, political wing, they had a command group, they had, you know, a organizational structure, even if it was decentralized, that managed the group. These current groups, these current organizations that we're fighting, starting in Iraq primarily, in terms of big ones, the Sunni insurgency, don't have that kind of infrastructure, don't have that kind of organizational structure. There are many, many different groups. And so, you know, what happened to the U.S. is when they went into Iraq and started going after the insurgents, they went in the classic fashion, as you know, you go up the pyramid, you flip somebody at the bottom of the pyramid and start to work your way up. In a classic insurgency, you'd finally, after many, many layers, get up to the command group and kill the command group, and the whole thing would collapse. Well, in this insurgency, they went up two layers, three layers, and boom, that was the end. That was the end of that group. But there was, you know, another 70 groups.
Yeah, it kind of makes me think of the difference between, say, the Italian and the Russian mafia. The Italian mafia was more centralized in their leadership. Well, the way the Russian mafia works is they don't have one leader that they all answer to. They're very decentralized.
Yeah, well, there's many, many different players. In Iraq, you know, and in many of the big conflict areas, in ISIS, is many different groups, and they're all different, motivated by different needs and desires and motivations for war. There's tribal groups, there's ideological groups, there's lots of different flavors of jihadi. There's not just one.
Would you say that ISIS has a state sponsorship in countries like, say, Saudi Arabia?
ISIS, no. Not, I mean, some portions maybe, but, you know, it appears that the majority of the functional cohesion comes from an open source metric, or open source means is that they're expanding based on a very simple principle that they want to expand Islamic law, and that's the minimal rule set that keeps everyone together. As long as you abide by that, any group can join.
What do you see unique about ISIS that is different than, say, Al Qaeda?
Al Qaeda, you know, started off as more of a hierarchy, had more structure, particularly in Afghanistan. They were much more focused on organizational structure, and that, you know, once that was broken up, they never really truly fully recovered from that. And as long as that leadership was in place, it was always kind of holding them back. And now this new organization really isn't so much an organization as it is a collective, and it's very, you know, focused on criminal activity to fund groups and keep the dynamic going. There's lots and lots of criminal type funding efforts, from bank robberies to stealing artifacts and selling them, to oil now and gas and everything that you can get your hands on, and running that to generate funds. And that goes a long ways to keeping the dynamic of the insurgency fluid.
I've noticed
growing.
Mostly because of technology, they've been able to faster spread to other parts of the world. I mean, throughout the Middle East and to parts of Europe like the UK as well. And Al Qaeda did that to a degree, but nowhere near the same degree and as rapidly. Would you say that's primarily because of their use of social media like Twitter?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to attribute it to that primarily. It may largely be due to the fact that there are a lot of different groups that have joined on, and they're not put through the kind of, you know, ideological hurdles, you know, that kind of testing or that litmus test that Al-Qaeda often did to try to maintain a purity of effort. And that, you know, that kind of big tent may actually allow it to expand faster. And then granted, you know, the social lubricants, you know, provided by technology make it easier. And there's a whole, if you let the doors open and let everyone participate, in a hot conflict that spans multiple states, it's going to attract a big group of followers. There's been a lot of people that have been participating for quite a long time, you know, in the Syrian conflict in particular. They go in and out of Europe, and that's a big conduit by itself.
And I know, I'm not necessarily endorsing these views myself, but I know with there's a lot of conspiracy theories going around saying ISIS was created by the CIA or Assad, but you disagree with those views.
That's just stupid. I mean, it's not even worth spending any time on.
Yeah.
I mean, look, at some point there may have been funding for one group or another that eventually had some kind of connection, at some kind of tenuous link to ISIS. I mean, but, you know, so did every other participant in the conflict. If you're fighting against Assad, are these people trying to say, okay, the only person that was against ISIS or the only group that was against ISIS was Assad and his government?
I mean,
I don't know. I mean,
there's the issue of funding, but some of those people, they go so far as to say it was a creation of that, which I think is really silly.
Well, it's like everything evil is the product of the U.S. It's clearly not the case. And the U.S. does make mistakes. It's just to tag everything and put it around their neck now. That's just stupid. I mean, it's just a waste of time.
So you really trace...
I mean, I like to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, you really trace the origin of ISIS, would you say. Did it originate during the Syrian war, particularly?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, when you rip down states and embroil them in a civil war, civil wars are the worst. Bring up the atrocities, long periods of fighting. You get the kind of bonding that you're getting within the small groups. And there's lots of different groups that became battle-hardened and tested as a result of that. That kind of stuff can create the kind of, you know, wave that we saw. But, you know, the expansion of ISIS into Iraq, I mean, it moved very, very quickly against, you know, little opposition, but it was way overextended. And that's why when I wrote about, you know, that even some, as they were approaching the Kurdish capital without, you know, meeting any meaningful opposition, the Peshmerga were falling back and melting. It was pretty clear that the thing that needed to happen was that they needed a little bit of bombing in order to slow that offensive. And when you're that spread out, the groups are very thin on the ground, and they're tired, and their supply chains and the logistics are very tenuous, and just some light bombing can cause them to, you know, fall back in disorder. And that's exactly what happened.
And
that day later, the U.S. started bombing.
And this is, I mean, this what's remarkable is ISIS is fairly new. I mean, it's really difficult to imagine or to predict what will happen in the next several years with ISIS.
Well, you know, it's a dynamic organization. It's kind of what I was, you know, well, largely what I was writing about back in, you know, 2007, 2008, when I said the U.S. hadn't really won Iraq. And even though, you know, they had adopted a kind of an open source counterinsurgency by, you know, adopting the Iraqi tribal groups and funding them to fight Al-Qaeda, which is, you know, it was almost like forced on the American military leadership. Petraeus didn't even see it. It wasn't part of his strategy. And it came up from the ground. You know, the guys on the, you know, the captains and the majors and the guys that, you know, actually dealing with the tribal groups directly to raise the issue to Petraeus' team and saying, you know, these guys don't want to fight a two-front war. They don't want to fight the Shia militias that are doing ethnic cleansing in Baghdad and other places on the one hand, and whenever they organize to try to stop the Shia militias from a neighborhood and get together, the U.S. pounds them. The U.S., you know, drops a hammer on their head. So they needed an ally on one side or the other. And Al-Qaeda wasn't helping either. I mean, Al-Qaeda wasn't providing them support. It was actually, I mean, they weren't really allies. So just by betraying, but, you know, 5% of the conflict, which was percent of their forces, which was Al-Qaeda, they were able to get significant support from the U.S.
Would you describe Hamas as a fourth-generation warfare?
No, it's traditional. I mean, fourth-generation warfare is not open source. Hamas largely created, you know, the Israelis keep it going. I guess, you know, I hadn't actually read the full WikiLeaks thing on this, but I mean, Israel keeps, you know, Gaza on the edge of humanitarian crisis, you know, as a tactic or a strategy. And I mean, from my point of view, that's not a sound strategy. Mainly because it makes resolution or you know, lessening of the conflict.
You're saying they want
to
keep
the best way to undermine Hamas and get rid of those rockets.
You're saying they would prefer to have someone more extreme, like you're saying that they would prefer to have someone more extreme in there, like Hamas, than someone more moderate.
Well, I mean, the fear is that they'll get more technology or, you know, more arms. If they loosen the controls, and so, or they allow any kind of economic activity to occur, so they keep the whole area on the edge of economic crisis. You know, so it's not quite a full-blown humanitarian crisis, but it's not thriving. But the perversity of that strategy in a modern context is that that's probably the only thing that will keep the conflict going. I mean, if you let wealth flow in, you let connectivity flow in, you let those connections from the outside, you know, from all the outside, you know, start to increase the wealth there. I mean, even a little, I mean, it's so few people in the Gaza Strip that if you, it would be very, very easy to get, you know, get the kind of funding necessary to start some significant employment there. Hamas wouldn't have a chance. Wouldn't have a chance. If people are getting wealthy, you don't want rockets in their neighborhood. You know what I mean?
Has ISIS made any inroads in Gaza or the West Bank?
I don't know. I mean, and I, you know, it's not a monolithic structure, so it's all kind of it's an open source movement. So it's a movement, not an organization where you can say, you know, here's a hierarchy.
Lots
of different groups, lots of different things going on.
Would you describe Hezbollah that way?
Hezbollah? Oh, Hezbollah is a fourth generation leader. I mean, it is the non-state guerrilla group that doesn't want to be the nation state, doesn't want to have control of Lebanon, doesn't want to actually, you know, be totally in charge, and is, you know, very, very structured and organized and you know, well run, and that, you know, in that it can survive and defend itself.
I guess what's different about Hezbollah is they actually, like, they provide social services.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a nation state. But, you know, modern models, I mean, is that, you know, you don't care so much about delivering the services. It's not, you know, you kind of overlay a level of, you know, virtual control. You know, a very simplistic kind of minimalist kind of structure for the region. In this case of ISIS, it would be Sharia law. That would be the minimal social cohesion and order, and everything else takes care of itself. It's very decentralized.
So your
social services aren't delivered. There isn't any organization or heart.
This topic is called Brave New War, The Next Stage of Terrorism and the End of Globalization. So this book came out in 2008. So, did you make any predictions about what's going on now in the book?
Well, if you want to find out how ISIS operates and, you know, where we're at right now, you got to read the book. I usually am, you know, 5 to 10 years ahead, so that's pretty much on track. I mean, I saw that, you know, read the tea leaves in terms of what was going on in Iraq, and that's what happened. I mean, Iraq is clearly not a win in the U.S. column, and neither will it be, you know, neither will Afghanistan be. So it's just one big waste of time and blood and money.
And explain what you mean by the end of globalization, because most people assume that we're going further into globalization.
End of globalization in terms of the way things were rolling out in the past, in kind of a structured, you know, nation state run, you know, gentlemen's club. And to a certain extent, we're still on that trajectory. It's becoming more of a Wild West, and the nation state is becoming less and less capable of defending us or providing us the security that gives them reason for existing. I mean, the primary purpose of the nation state is security. And you know, the whole 20th century is one big case for the bureaucratic nation state.
And a lot of
you know, it became such a.
A lot of people associate fourth-generation warfare or non-state warfare with the Middle East. But obviously, I mean, it's gone on a lot in places like South America, Southeast Asia. But do you see this type of stuff with open-source warfare spreading to places like Europe and the United States?
Eventually, it's all really tied to the economic performance. I mean, Europe and the U.S. and have been stagnating for years. We'll see where they go. You know, as those economies continue to decline, largely due to, you know, mismanagement by an aging bureaucracy, that, you know, failing to come up with ways to justify further dominance, and then, you know, and it's being looted systematically by a financial system that's, you know, grew up in tandem with the bureaucratic nation state, and that isn't really providing and never has provided anything meaningful in terms of economic progress. You know, one of the things I've stuck to or discovered as part of my economic research is that, you know, the financial myth associated with capitalism is really is really overwrought. Is that, you know, financial dominance, the idea that banks and markets are, you know, financial markets are the key to capitalist progress is, you know, far from the truth. It's actually much more business focused. You know, places where the finance has been predominant have seen relatively little economic progress.
And can you give examples of nations that are less dependent on finance?
Well, nobody now. I mean, we're all kind of hamstrung by a global financial system that grew up in tandem with the nation-state bureaucracy in the 20th century. And you look back at, you know, prior to World War I, the nation-state was really, you know, a protean structure. It was really, really small. It wasn't able to fund itself. It wasn't able to do much in terms of services. It was tiny. And the financial system was relatively small, too. Most business was conducted at the local level, and there was trade, but you know, it was based on, you know, investing in stuff that you saw locally. You understood the businesses, you understood, and growing those businesses. And while there were occasional booms and busts, they were, you know, on the edges of the economic innovation that was going on. And there was a lot of innovation. There was, you know, like electricity and phones and things like that happening in the 1800s in the U.S. that largely had very little to do with any kind of financial sophistication. I mean, U.S. financial markets were
Yeah, negligible.
Yeah,
because that's very important to point out because it's been the message in politics that it's the politicians and the media will say it's absolutely necessary to have an economy based on finance. And people just take it for granted.
Oh, and it's also absolutely necessary to have an economy based on a big government bureaucracy to protect us, manage it. But that kind of that combination of, you know, financial size and you know, bureaucratic management only really came, you know, to its fullest extent after World War II. And if you look at the numbers for the United States, in particular, because we were, you know, under-financialized and under-governed up to that point. But up to that point, up to World War II, the U.S. was the most dynamic economy in the world. It was so far ahead of everybody else, it wasn't even – nobody else was even close. And on a per capita basis, we were producing more wealth over that first 150 years of our existence than had ever been seen in the history of mankind. And we were dragging the entire rest of the world behind us, you know, kicking and screaming often into the future with economic progress, you know, new technology that was applied to
so,
quality and standard of life. But, you know, after World War II, it was all different. It was all this, you know, big bureaucratic nation state being financed by a tax system that was made possible because finance was growing big and protected and regulated and controlled and managed. We saw how it was managed and protected during the latest financial crisis. The Federal Reserve is still, you know, it has, you know, $5 trillion in subsidies it gave to the financial system after that crisis. $5 trillion. And shoot, the entire, and just, you know, straight subsidies, straight dollars go straight into the financial
system. Yeah, I mean, that kind of amount of money, it's just hard even, it's just such a vast amount, you can't even picture the meaning of that, the value of that money.
Every single financial or student loan in the United States, have totaled all together, all the student loans together, is $1 trillion. So it could have written off every one of those, or at least give them a zero interest rate or 0.1 interest rate, 0.1% interest rate. Just pay off the principal, a one-time deal.
And again, basically,
and that would have been one-fifth of what they gave the banks.
Yeah, when they bailed out the banks, the public were lied to that if you didn't bail out the banks, our whole economy would collapse.
Well, they were just, you know, we were just looking at the numbers that were coming out of the federal government. I mean, that direct kind of loans and subsidies. It didn't take into account everything the Fed did, because the Fed's off balance book, or, you know, off the balance sheets, off the books. It took all this direct and gambling, all these gambling, you know, chits and receipts that the banks all had left over after the crisis hit. You know, that were worthless, because all these guys were speculating, you know, on the public money, basically, what we found out later, to make their bonus checks. And then they gave that to the Federal Reserve, and they took it at face value. And they lent them money at virtually 0% interest that they could then use to continue to repair their balance sheets. So why were they being, you know, repaired when the rest of us didn't get that kind of benefit? The whole thing is just messed. I mean, it's so screwed up, it's hard to even explain it in a way that doesn't sound, you know, completely cynical and jaded. I mean,
it really
is a screwed up system.
That will be one of the key issues. I think economic situations will play a major factor in open source warfare.
Yeah, I mean, the economy's changing pretty quickly. I mean, you know, one thing people aren't seeing is that the entire economic growth that, you know, system, you know, that we've been sold since World War II is this idea that we're going to have more and more bureaucratic jobs. And the way you get ahead in bureaucracy is get an education. You go out and get credentials. And those credentials allow you to move ahead in the bureaucracy, and those credentials allow you to differentiate yourself from other people. You know, the more checks on your resume, the check boxes you fill, the farther you go along. And everything's, you know, in a bureaucracy, everything's a scarce resource. There's only a certain number of people that get the next level. A certain number of people can go to graduate school. A certain number of people can do this or that. And it's, you know, it's considered a kind of a rational management system. Well, all of that was based, we've changed all of our lives from, you know, operating our own businesses and building homes that are productive and able to, you know, provide us income, sources of income. We changed all of that, thrown that all away, and moved to a system where we're focused on working in this bureaucracy, either corporate bureaucracy or government bureaucracy.
Corporate bureaucracy or government bureaucracy, it's called managerialism. Are you familiar with the James Burnham book, The Managerial Revolution?
Yeah, I mean, I got an MBA. So I went through the whole process, too. I mean, I worked at the DOD, which is the biggest bureaucracy in the U.S., actually, probably in the world.
That's the Department of Justice.
I don't know. I mean, DOD is pretty – Department of Defense.
Oh, Department of Defense.
Yeah, it's huge. That's all changed because, you know, as of that financial crisis, government hiring has stopped, and then it started reversing. And now it's going down at all levels. I mean, you could see it. I have a chart that shows that, you know, government hiring increasing steadily year on year on year, year after year, all the way from World War One to 2007 or 8. And then it hits that bump and then goes down for the first time, a really steep decline. And all of this kind of, you know, lack of recovery and everything else that we're seeing is that they've expanded to the limits of their capacity.
And the
they're
same,
still running, you know, nearly $1 trillion in deficit every year.
And the same would be said about, I mean, corporations, it's not like when people have their own businesses, a lot of the jobs are bureaucratic. And those jobs, there's a limit of, there's basically the same thing where there's a zero-sum game and there's a limited number of those jobs as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the government, through its policies, enforced a kind of bureaucratic, meritocratic system on the corporate world as well, and they adopted it in large part often to work with the government because many of the contracts and many of the things you do have to go through government hoops in order to get done. So we have this vast corporate structure, vast bureaucratic structure, and it's all halted. And the jobs that they said, you know, finally we've got the jobs back. We have as many jobs as we did before the crash, just this last month, I think it was. But these jobs on average pay 23% less, almost a quarter less than they did back in 2007. So these good – and they likely don't even have the kind of benefit structure that these old jobs did. It's showing that those old bureaucratic jobs are being destroyed. They're being gutted. The government has for a long period of time been the kind of last vestige, you know, last – refuge of somebody who's like seeking, you know, middle class lifestyle.
Yeah, I know. It's getting so bad. I know some people have proposed like a guaranteed minimum income because they're just saying there's not enough jobs for everyone.
Yeah, well, you know, that's not going to happen. And the reason why it's not going to happen is because no one's going to sign off. I mean, capital is just too mobile now. Any country that starts to try to, you know, extract the income necessary or taxes necessary to do that is going to see massive capital flooding. And it's also – it's almost – you know, that kind of proposal is almost I've looked at it. It's interesting, but it's kind of a way to extend the current dysfunction, you know, this idea that we have a population that – you know, it's moving through this bureaucratic education system. It was one of the biggest bureaucracies, you know, is the education system. We go to a bureaucracy to learn, to get an education so we can advance in the bureaucracy.
So you'd say the two reasons education is so expensive is number one, the banking system, and number two, the education bureaucracy.
Oh, well, one of the big reasons why the education is so expensive, and same reason why the medical expenses have gone up so high, is that there's almost like a we've set up a blank check by increasing the number of loans and the ease of getting loans, largely by making those loans guaranteed for life. They're not dischargeable in bankruptcy anymore. Is that you've created a bidding war. You created an artificial kind of source of income for schools. And you've been telling people relentlessly that the only way that they can get ahead and the only way they can get to into the middle class or retain their position in the middle class is to keep on going back and getting more school, getting more education. Even though that the number of jobs, the number of slots available for them to actually realize that, benefit is in decline.
And healthcare works the same way.
The same way, yeah. We keep on expanding the amount of insurance dollars that we're willing to spend in order to provide us the care we want, which now the government's getting involved and the like. And in both cases, in both the educational system and as well as the medical system, we've also regulated the hell out of it. The government prevents change. So whenever somebody comes in with something that could cause a change or could disrupt what's there, they're stopped in their tracks. Like in medical, there was a service called 23andMe. Familiar with them?
Yes. It gets.
Okay, yeah, they do the genetic testing.
Yeah, genetic testing.
Yeah, it's an amazing service. For $100, you get a lifetime of genetic information. I mean, they did the initial genetic assay, and they started to give you all the journal articles and all the literature associated with your genetic information. So you were starting to get a whole flow of information about medical conditions that could impact you. And you could see how this was going in terms of the amount of information that you were able to get for free, effectively, as a lifetime service, and how this could evolve into as the kind of platform for personalized medicine, where you start to combine the kind of individual monitoring you get from a kind of the wearable healthcare or wearable like Fitbits, but plus, not that particular product, but what comes after that, with what you're getting in terms of genetic information, you're getting services, you're getting social connectivity where you're connecting to other people with similar conditions, you're getting kind of personal screening and advice for very low cost, and it could be a way to actually lower healthcare costs substantially. Because personalized medicine, where a lot more of it is done specifically for you and done via technology outside of the old system, has a potential lowering the cost of healthcare to one-tenth or less than what it costs today, just like technology has been able to do in so many different other places. But they stopped it. The FDA stopped it. They didn't even have a regulation that prevented what they were doing. But they interpreted their mandate in a way that allowed them to say, you can't put health – you can't give too much information to people.
So is it shut down
this
completely?
This information is too dangerous.
Is it shut down completely?
Well, they're not completely shut down. They were prevented from giving their customers any medical information associated with any of the journal articles.
So I think basically people – like you can do it and you can research like – your ancestry, for instance, and that's fine, but just the medical part you can't do.
But, what the hell is the FDA doing in that? stopping that kind of innovation. But that's just one example. It happens so often now. It's like, okay, so the FAA, for instance, shut down use of drones in commercial activities. Just as we're particularly in terms of, drones for... And drones have a potential of being used badly, usually when they're used within large-scale organizations, like the DOD using them as vehicles for assassination and the like. But the thing is, what's more interesting to me is that their potential use as an internet for small packages, like Amazon was proposing as kind of a delivery system for the kind of small packages that they send out. But they have a potential to go even farther than that, is that makes it possible for you to have like a little container that you can put out anywhere on your porch or on your whatever, and then that can, with the appropriate tag and accessing it via your cell phone, send it across the United States for a quarter. Now send a pound across the United States for a quarter, or maybe even a dollar.
It would provide. So you're saying, could it make the U.S. Postal Department obsolete?
Well, it would set up a whole thing where you could move around small packages of a couple pounds or less, small dimensions, using these small drones to pick them up automatically, fly them a couple miles point to point at treetop level, drop them off, and then go recharge at a little station, and everyone can have, you could be provider of your own drone. And that kind of small matter, the small package transportation system, isn't something we even have. Not at a quarter, for a flight of 2 or 3 miles or a quarter across the country.
So, yeah, it could.
That changes everything, changes the dynamics, changes, like, never go to CVS with your car again. to get a small package of things.
Also think about the ecological benefits amount of gas you'd save.
Oh, and these are all super efficient, point to point. You want to send your send a little package across town, it's done. It just happens. You just put the thing out, order on your phone, boom, boom, it's gone. And there's uses now that we can't even think of. But the FAA stopped it cold. Wanted to spend years in the regulatory set. This is exactly opposite of the kind of innovation during these like transition periods that needs to happen. And the U.S. used to be able to do this. This is how. It's just so sad to see the U.S. kind of get caught, get constricted, get hamstrung in this way, by a government that does this and a financial system that just sucks the life out of everything. It's just terrible, and it's also terrible to see that, to watch people get so upset that they're not able to make any forward progress, but they don't know why, and they're not willing to accept the obvious. But these two new systems, these two new things, that said that they were always there or they're always in control, they haven't been always in control, and they haven't always been there. Are the things that are holding us back from many, getting to the next phase, next part of development. I think the way we're going to have to be able to do it, if we're going to do it, was, getting back to that economic independence. Real economic independence. I mean, the low debt or no debt, and owning assets that actually are productive, instead of just assets that cost us money. But, without that, then it's probably going to be a lot more disruptive in the West. And, it's about evolution over time.
The
stuff I'm working on right now is about drones, so we'll see or bots in general. And it's pretty, pretty cool stuff.
Before we get to the end, is there anything else about open source warfare that we didn't touch upon that you would say is really, really important to get to?
One thing about the open source warfare is that it isn't only about, groups that act violently. It can also be used in a nonviolent fashion. And we saw it work really effectively in terms of protest, in terms of how it toppled Tunisia, how it toppled Egypt. Lots and lots of different groups, nobody in charge. Anybody that spent too much time negotiating or whatever was pushed to the side. And they focused on one goal. In the case of Egypt, they said, get rid of Mubarak. They did it. They kept them. Anyone who was willing to move that goal, that ball forward towards the goalpost, was followed. Anyone who was trying to go off to negotiate a new constitution or off to do this or that was sidelined. The typical power grabs that happen in most insurgencies.
Or also other examples would be Julian Assange and Edward Snowden.
Edward Snowden, he's more on the IWAR front because, like any employee in any big organization now, employees can be once you free them up enough to and power them enough with the kind of tools that make them truly effective at their job, they become your biggest threat. If you're doing stuff that's immoral, and you know, anytime all the WikiLeaks thing about, you know, every WikiLeak that caused damage was only really causing damage if it was tied to an immoral activity. I mean, if no one got mad about anything else. It's when they were, you know, advocating this or that, or that was clearly the wrong thing to do, that they weren't willing to say in public.
John Robb, I'd like to thank you for being on the show.
All right. Well, have fun.
That's all we have for today.
It was my pleasure.
Thanks again. That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.